This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Tim Sayer, MBE. Good afternoon, Tim.
Good afternoon, William.
And perhaps we could start with the MBE issue. That makes you a master of the British Empire, is this true?
I think you've got that a little bit wrong, William. I think it's a member of the British Empire.
Member?
Or something like
a
that.
A member, yes, of the British Empire.
Something like that.
How do you achieve such a status?
Well, I'd like to ask you why you thought it was an issue.
Well, because in every correspondence that I receive from you,
yes,
every email,
yes,
it says quite clearly at the bottom, Tim Sayer, MBE.
Indeed.
So you actually broadcast the fact that you have an MBE.
Well, yes.
You also you sport a sort of upside down cross on your lapel.
Well, you're wrong there because it's the right way up, actually.
Well, it looks like
your eyes.
It looks like it's upside down, which looks kind of sort of slightly sinister.
I don't think there's anything sinister about it at all, William. No.
But that is a badge, isn't it?
It is a sort of small badge, and I was given a rather larger one at Buckingham Palace to denote that I had been awarded or appointed a member of the British Empire. Yes.
Yes. Honoured, even.
Well, I felt honoured, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'll explain that later. But
will you?
Yes, I'll do my best.
Okay. Well, we don't want to rattle through it too quickly, do we?
We're not.
If we sort of rush through the MBE issue, we might not have enough time for the other matters which are pressing. But
it's in your hands, will you?
Well, in 2003, the Sunday Times published a list of the people who had rejected the order of the British Empire, including David Bowie, Nigella Lawson, L.S. Lowry, George Melly and J.G. Ballard. In addition, Ballard voiced his opposition to the honour system, calling it a preposterous charade.
Well, you could agree with that, but my attitude was, well, the point is, William, we haven't gone into my reasons for being offered an MBE, have we?
Not yet, no.
Perhaps we should start with that rather than going straight into the issue of why I accepted it.
Lennon later returned his MBE insignia in 1969 as part of his ongoing peace protest. And then,
quite right, too,
and then we've got people like Robert Morley and actress Vanessa Redgrave who apparently refused. And then Roald Dahl refused being decorated, allegedly because he wanted a knighthood so that his wife would be entitled to the title Lady Dahl.
Lady Dahl. Yeah, I like it.
Indeed.
Well, when the envelope from St. James Palace or wherever it was arrived at our house...
Out of the blue.
My wife was so excited she opened it and looked at it and she said, oh, it's only an MBE. I can't call myself Lady
Sayer. She can't be Lady Sayer.
Yeah, exactly.
No, exactly. So she was disappointed.
She was very disappointed, but I told her, well, if we'll work on it, and who knows? And
I was going to say,
knows,
can you work?
Might happen.
Can you actually up the ante? Achieve greater prowess after?
It depends how much charitable, philanthropic, and other work one does.
Ah,
yes.
So now we're okay.
Well, you didn't ask the right question, did
well,
you?
Well, no, I didn't. I was waiting for you to launch into it because, as I knew, you would.
Quite.
Okay.
Right. Well, let me... go on.
But how do you feel about the MBE?
I accepted the MBE, or let's just say I was offered the MBE for charitable, for philanthropic work and services to the arts, mostly based on my wife, Anne-Marie Norton, and my decision to bequeath our collection to the Hepworth Gallery in Wakefield.
Right.
Collection and the books, the contents of the house itself.
Yeah.
So we made that decision. And because of that, we were... It was decided that I was worthy of an MBE. And I decided to accept it, not on behalf of myself, but I like to say on behalf of the Hepworth Gallery in Wakefield, as I said, the people who work there, the local people.
Yeah.
And because it would be good for the Hepworth. It would draw more attention to them. And it's been very useful.
Has it? In what way is it useful?
People say, oh, this man's an MBE, he must be something. We better listen to him when he's suggesting we should...
Is that work?
It has done, yeah. People say, oh, yeah, we might give you a bit of art and things like that. Yes. I've only fallen out with one friend over it.
Do tell me about this. Well, please.
He's a violinist and he can just about bring himself to speak to me. But he says, oh, you've become a member of the establishment. And I say, well, you're a violinist. You play with pianists who've got various honours. Oh, that's different, he says. And is it different? I don't know.
Well, I suppose it's the business of the British Empire, isn't it?
It's ludicrously outdated, isn't it?
It is in a way. Yeah. I mean, I don't blame you. I don't know what I'd do. I mean, if I was awarded an MBE for having broadcast on Resonance for sort of 16 years, would I send it back?
Probably not. Probably not, I suspect.
Tell me about the actual machinations of it. How did it? What happened? You got a letter out of the blue. Who nominates you for such a thing?
I was told by the director of a well-known gallery, public gallery in London, that I'd get a gong for this decision to. And I said, "Oh, don't be silly."
Yeah.
And then in April last year, this letter arrived, and I think I was probably nominated by the Hepworth Gallery and Wakefield Council.
Right.
And so it arrives, you fill in the form saying I'd be delighted. It's then you mustn't tell anybody.
That you've been nominated?
You mustn't know that you've been awarded.
Awarded? Yeah, oh, really?
You can't say anything until it's officially announced in the Queen's birthday honours in June, you see.
Right, okay.
So one had to keep very quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, so that was June last year, and April the 1st, that would have been a good one, February the 1st this year,
yep.
I went along to Buckingham Palace and Prince Charles pinned this honour on me and we had a nice chat.
Only Prince Charles? The Queen doesn't do this thing? Or?
She does, but it was her day off. Or she was up, corgi racing or something. Right. I don't know what she gets up to.
So you get to meet Prince Charles?
Yes.
And he pins it on you. Is there a whole sort of, are there sort of hundreds of people queuing up to receive this thing?
I think there were 78 of us that day.
Right.
And you hang around. It's a very, very, very informal. You're immediately put at your ease. I went with Anne-Marie, my wife, and the director of the Hepworth and his PA, Kirsty, the director, Simon Wallace, his PA, Kirsty Fountain. And we were segregated immediately. The recipients, as we're called, went up one staircase and the others went up another.
Yeah.
And we were briefed on how to behave, how to bow and how to address
curtsy.
HRH. Well, I decided not to curtsy in case I spit my dress. You never know.
Okay.
And we went off in batches.
Really?
And
in batches,
12 at a time or something. And you walk round behind at the back of the ballroom and there's Prince Charles at the other end congratulating people.
Yeah.
And eventually you get to see him and he asked, he said, well, I think, I don't think this is breaking your confidence. And he said, I think you've done a wonderful thing here, giving your collection or bequeathing your collection to the Hepworth.
So presumably he's got notes before, because with 78 people to go through, it must be difficult to actually
extremely
get
well
the handle
briefed.
On it.
He's got notes in which he probably underlines a number of points, and then I think an aide whispers in his ear as one approaches him.
Right.
I mean...
And where is your wife during all this?
She's in the audience.
There's an audience?
Well, yes.
The others?
The others.
The
other staircase, you see.
Oh, I see.
They sit in the ballroom and wait for us all to arrive.
Your wife was a ballerina, I think.
She was, yes.
Yeah. Mm. Could you tell me a bit about that? Was she a famous ballerina?
No, I don't think she was necessarily famous, but she trained with the Royal Ballet in Richmond Park and at Baron's Court.
Right.
And then when she was quite young, she went off to dance for the Dutch National for about 10 years.
Okay.
And I think she was pretty well known there.
Right. Yeah. I think she still dances, doesn't she?
She doesn't dance, no.
No?
No, she had to give up dancing. She had to give up dancing because of injuries, which, of course, injuries affect a lot of dancers.
Right.
Mostly
leg
or shin and ankle and various places like that.
Okay.
And now she makes beautiful costumes for the theatre, the ballet, the opera, and musicals.
Including, so, I think there was some reference to Monty Python, is that right? Did I see
I
a reference?
She did something. Yes, she did when they revived, and she also did something for Kate Bush, a recent revival, and the recent Swan Lake at Covent Garden.
Right.
So,
right.
William, if you'd ever like a tutu made, Amory is the girl to do it for you.
Fantastic.
Would that be all right?
Absolutely.
Thank
you very
much. Money,
I could wear it on my head, couldn't I?
Well, I don't think you could. I think you'd look very, very elegant in the tutu, if I may say so.
Well, thank you very much, Tim.
I'll take that as
a compliment.
Of course it is.
Okay, so the two of you, you and Anne-Marie, you occupy a house in Islington.
Highbury, actually. I know it's the London Borough of Islington, but we think of Highbury as being a bit superior.
Do you?
Well, it's very quiet where we live. Very quiet, sorry.
Okay. Fair enough. So you chose to live in Highbury, having been brought up in Teddington, I think?
Yes.
And you then became a hoarder.
I thought you said something else for a minute. Sorry.
No.
A collector, I think.
A collector, sorry. I'm being a bit mischievous.
Yes,
I am
being
mischievous.
Yes. Yeah, I always collected dinky toys and magazines and
did
books.
Did you? I did, yes. But, yeah, in your Teddington days.
In my Teddington days, and my school days. And when I was 17... I always used to go to junk shops in Twickenham and Richmond because you could buy 18th century books for next to nothing in those days, 10 shillings, brackets 50 pence.
There was a famous old bookshop, wasn't there, right on the river?
Up the hill.
No, right on the riverbank. I can't remember, and the man that ran it was sort of he used to appear in James Bond films and just had this terribly shabby sort of bookshop right by. I can't remember where it is now.
I don't remember one on the river. I remember Eric Barton, who had a bookshop going up the hill. And if you didn't go to the right school, he didn't want to speak to you.
Is this in Wimbledon or Twickenham?
This is in Richmond.
I remember, in Richmond.
In Richmond.
Yes, I remember that one. Because this is sort of how we got met in the first place, wasn't it, via books. We know each other through bookshops.
Indeed.
And book collecting.
Yes.
So, basically, through Marcus Campbell Art Books.
Does he pay you to say that?
Not at all, no.
I'm just wondering.
That's all right, no. And you habitually, you go to art fairs and occasionally help out, I think, on Marcus's stall.
I do, yes. I enjoy selling.
Yeah. Do you?
Oh, yes. I enjoy talking to people and chatting up the potential punter.
Yeah. But you never became a dealer as such.
No. I didn't want to risk my money.
But you've collected avidly for many, many years. Filling the house in Islington, Highbury, where every square inch apparently of the house is covered in paintings.
I like the apparently. Is that a dig?
Well,
I haven't been. No, I'm sorry. You will be invited.
You have invited me.
Yes,
it's just never worked out.
We found an excuse to cancel it.
Yeah.
Can't remember what it was, but it was jolly.
Well, because you didn't want bohemians in the house, I think.
No, I don't think it was like that at all, William. You would have been most welcome, except we had something better to do, I think.
Right. But anyway, so your house is notorious for being full of art.
Yes.
Is that fair enough?
It is packed.
To the extent you have been, you're something of a sort of, when one Googles you, there are numerous interviews with you, with all the papers and the radio and the TV who've all sort of gravitated towards your house in order to get the story on this art collection.
Yeah, you're a bit slow then, aren't you, really?
Well, that's why I'm hoping to get to something else. I'm hoping we might be able to dig over and dig through this and not repeat the stuff that people...
Well, yes, it would be very boring for the listener.
What if they've already traced your lineage, as it were? But let's tell me about your art collecting. How did it start?
Well, as I said, I had already collected a lot of old books,
yeah,
which were very cheap in those days. And I went into a junk shop in Richmond in 1962 when I was 17. So you can work out that I'm now 73.
Right.
And there was a portfolio of 183 prints,
right,
from the 17th to the 19th century. I know there were 183 because I've still got the list.
Right.
And that again was 10 shillings, 50 pence, so I thought I'd buy it. And took them home, and I was living with my mum in Teddington, and she was interested in them, so we framed a few. And then I left school the next year and had to go out to work, so didn't think much about art for a couple, 3 or 4 years. And then I think in 1969 I went to the Royal Academy Summer Show with a friend, and there was a print I liked the look of, and it was 5 guineas, which is £5.25, including frame, which was an attraction because a lot of the stuff there is sold unframed.
Right. Right.
And it was a...
So I'm trying to do that equation in my head about 5 guineas being £5.25, actually. A guinea was a pound and a shilling, wasn't it?
Yes.
You're right.
I am right. I tend to be right, William. Yeah, you stick to your job.
Yeah, okay. No,
put the calculator away.
Whilst you were talking, I was thinking to myself, how much is five guineas in new money, you know?
Yes.
It's sort of...
Yes.
Okay.
So that sort of started me off, I suppose. Excuse me.
That's right.
And
would you like to? Would you want to have a drink? I could play some Salvador Dali whilst you're having.
Well, it depends how keen you are. This is Salvador Dali talking about what?
I've got a flexi disc of Salvador Dali called L'Apotheose du Dollar. Raconté par Salvador Dali, which was a sort of flexi disc which I bought in Nice. And
what did you pay for it?
£25.
You were done.
No. It's a rare record, and I thought it might come in handy. I thought it's at that point when you wanted to have a drink of water, if you needed
I've been drinking
to stop,
water,
I could play the Dali. Or are you all right?
I tell you what. Why don't you put the Dali on?
Okay.
And if it's so bad, you can fade it almost immediately.
All right. We can have a listen to.
Good man.
Si, Salvador Dali. Nommé par un anagramme par André Breton, à vida dollar. Lequel anagramme avait été fait.
You can talk over the top if you like.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I was looking at your. I was pretty sure he was still on.
Yeah.
Sounds very precise, doesn't it?
Very precise. His enunciation was immaculate. He should have been a broadcaster.
I could have given him a job on the BBC.
Indeed, we'll get to the BBC eventually.
Will we? But if we must.
Well, I thought we'd carry on with the art for a bit. I mean, we should sort of... tell me more about the art collection, Tim.
So we've definitely got rid of poor... Let's give Dali a little bit more, shall we? Just a...
Qui me procure autant de satisfaction... Que sentir cette pluie monotone et divine de dollars. Il y a une autre côté qui amusera tous les gens qui m'écoutent, c'est que justement Auguste Comte.
See, someone, there was a joke, wasn't there, about his name? It was an anagram of avid à dollars.
Yeah, I can believe that.
That's
which
he why was. I think that's why the surrealists threw him out, because he became sort of terribly avid at dollars.
Yeah, that's all he was interested in.
But you know, the art, which brings us back to the art world and your collection.
My collecting.
And you buying art. And that, and now you've, you see, you amassed this collection, which includes some very fine pieces.
Which you still haven't seen.
I haven't seen. You've got a Gerhard Richter, apparently.
No, I flogged it.
Oh.
Quite recently. But then I bought a Picasso, so it balanced out a bit.
But surely the Richter is part of the collection. I mean, does the Hepworth Museum know that the Richter is
no
longer?
They are only too well aware that I have flogged it, yes.
You flogged it because...
Because I was broke. Seems a good enough reason, doesn't it?
Right. Dare I ask how much it fetched?
No, you daren't.
Why not?
Because it's none of your business.
Okay. So it went for a lot of money.
It didn't, no.
What was it? What date was it?
It was about 91, I think it was a drawing. It was a wash drawing. It wasn't a major. Okay. It wasn't a major Richter. So don't
right.
get any.
So probably £30,000.
Possibly, I couldn't possibly comment.
All right. So you're remaining discreet about that one, but you bought a Picasso with it.
I'd say you bought a discreet.
Okay. Yes. All right. That's your prerogative.
Thank you.
And you bought a Picasso with it.
A small print. Yes.
Even though you were broke.
Well, I made enough money for a little bit to be over, too.
All right, okay.
But my whole life has been consisting of periods when I've been completely broke, and even then I've spent money. When I've had money, I've spent it. When I've not had money, I've spent it.
Right, okay.
Amazing how you do it.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah,
yes.
Fair enough.
Because poor Amory, she has kittens.
Really?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. So tell me more about the art kind of gathered momentum.
The art gathered momentum. It sort of started with an interest in modern British and then went on to various contemporary art movements. I forged friendships with quite a few.
I wonder what you were going to say for a minute.
What did you think I was
going to say?
You were
going to say I forged signatures or
no,
something.
No, that comes later.
Oh, okay.
No, that's
forged,
no problem.
You forged friendships, sorry.
With various art dealers and artists. Yeah. So I became involved in the art world. I've worked...
Don't worry about that.
No, I'm not. I'm just worrying the needle is going round and round and ought to take it off. It's
a Dali. No, it's just Dali. He's still talking.
He's not still talking.
He is. Fuss him.
Qui est un de mes apothéos.
Good value, that one.
Yes, you see. You thought I'd been done.
Fantastic. Yeah, I really thought you'd been taken for a ride.
No. Okay. So tell me, you worked for some art galleries for a while.
I did work. Yes.
Did you not?
I still do.
Do you?
At art fairs. There's a very nice gallery in North London called the Beardsmore Gallery.
Okay.
For whom I've worked for quite a few years. Before that, a man called Jonathan Blonde, who ran Blonde Fine Art in firstly in Sackville Street, then in Hanover Street, then went off to Shoreditch, and he introduced me to various artists who were up and coming at that time: Eileen Cooper, John McFadden, Neil Jeffries, Timothy Hyman, and they did form part of my collection. But as my taste developed, I tended to move away. That was all figurative. Representational artist, and I've tended to go away from the narrative type of art.
Right.
And apart from self-portraits, which I'm very keen on, or portraits and self-portraits, which I'm very keen on, so I now tend to collect abstract work.
Okay. And you still collect it, even though, I mean, you've bequeathed your...
Yes.
Tell me again the difference between bequeathing and donating.
When you bequeath something... The gallery only gets it when you're dead.
Right.
If you donate it, you give it to them.
Okay.
We've given to the Hepworth 52 pieces already, because after the announcement of our bequest, they asked me if I'd put on a show up there of about 100 works.
Oh, right.
That was 2 years ago, and that lasted for about 4 or 5 months. And we decided they could keep a few of those, and we gave them a few more, but there are still about another 400 or so works in London.
And it sounds like you're continuing to sort of top up the collection then. You sort of sell one, you bequeath some, you donate.
I must make the point, in case anybody at the Hepworth is getting worried, I very, very rarely sell things.
Just the best ones.
No, I don't think so.
I'm sure you... Tell me what the best ones are. What have you got in there? What are the gems of the collection?
Gems of the collection. My God, what a difficult question. I have a very beautiful nude drawing by Anthony Caro, the great British sculptor, dated 1986. I could never afford any of his sculptures, but that is very beautiful.
Right.
The collection really varies between well-known people like Tony Caro. I've got a little Alexander Calder drawing, Prunella Clough, who is pretty well-known, Arthur Boyd, one of the most famous Australian artists, along with Sid Nolan.
Yeah,
it's a combination of quite famous people and lesser
right.
known, as it were.
So, yeah.
There are great highlights. Also, I've got quite a few beautiful abstract works by Rebecca Salter, who is the current keeper of the RA Schools And I've known her for a long time, and I've steadily admired her work.
Right, right, right. Okay, so this collecting, this spans how many years? What, 40 years or so?
No, I think more like 50.
50, really?
Something.
So it started when you were 17?
17, yes.
With this collection of prints.
So that's 56 years.
Yeah.
And of course it has, prints were the basis of it, but of course it went in almost every direction. I always say, we don't have any performance art and we don't have any video art, but virtually everything else is part of the collection. Sculpture, photography, drawings, prints, oils, watercolours, ceramics, tribal art, antiquities.
On the way here, we dropped in, didn't we, at the tanks in Tate Modern, because I wanted to show you an installation by an American artist called Jordan Wolfson, which is a sort of mechanical puppet which gets dropped to the ground mechanically, and then every so often you get a blast of When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge.
Whoever he is?
Percy Sledge? You must have known When a Man Loves a Woman.
No, I'm tremendously ignorant.
All right.
Do you want to play some of it now?
No, I haven't got it with me. You couldn't not hear have heard it. But anyway, all right. In fact, it features in another film. Anyway, we won't go into that.
No, better not.
So you took against it a bit, I think. You did not like the installation.
I thought it was rather gratuitously violent and unpleasant, but...
Right.
And I think a lot of people I'm not sure myself what it was getting at, but there were a lot of school children there laughing at it. And so I imagine they were just laughing at the noise and the way the doll, whatever you call it, was being crashed around on these chains.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a certain nervous laughter because the...
Of relief, as it were, when it happens.
Well,
yes,
no. Yes. I think it's because the puppet seems to be mutilating itself. It's sort of like crashing to the ground
Indeed.
And banging its head.
There's and a certain, then it comes up and says something and felt. Yes.
But you're not interested in this kind of art, or is it just that particular artwork?
It failed to move me or inspire me.
So what kind of art do you think, do you have a sort of preference for, you know, what makes you collect or buy a particular piece of art?
I think if it hits me in various places, in the head, the heart, the stomach.
And
I knew we were coming.
It has to hit you four ways.
Yes.
It's strange because the puppet sort of mutilates itself, but you
didn't hit me in all those ways. No. I just wanted to leap over the barrier and kick the wretched thing.
All right. But you like your art to be more. What's the word? Aesthetically...
it has to be aesthetically...
Ameliorative.
And challenging as well. You need to be challenged by the art. And I didn't feel I was challenged by that piece at all.
No. Is any of your art in your collection challenging?
It's a very awkward, difficult question to answer, which
Good.
Is... I thank you for doing that, but...
We can move on if you want.
No, I couldn't possibly move on.
All right.
I think... Once somebody said to me, and I agreed with them, that I would be quite happy sitting looking at a white canvas all day. Because, I don't know, I feel drawn into a lot of work. And
have you got any white canvases?
Not quite.
No. But
verging on it.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Who have you got? Anyone sort of like, I don't know, Robert Ryman?
Well, no, I wish I did have a Robert Ryman, but some of Rebecca Salter's, as mentioned earlier, her work is pretty minimal,
right. Okay.
It makes me reflect on various matters. I'm not a great believer in art talk and art, that rude word we use.
There's a friend of mine does a blog called, I think it's called Art Gobbledygook.
Ah, yes.
Which is sort of this art speak.
Yes.
Which attempts to I don't know what's the word. Elucidate or explain or
yes.
So that's what that's the kind of thing you're talking about.
That's the kind of thing that
any art writing or are there any? I mean, what about people like Brian Sewell or something? Would that Are there any art writers that you might sort of...
Sewell was an interesting person. He wrote very well about cars, I remember, in the Evening Standard. And oddly enough, I think he liked Joseph Beuys, which you would not have thought was one of his subjects at all. He could be very rude. He could be extraordinarily vituperative. Could you turn that little turntable?
Yes,
it was distracting me as I gazed into your eyes.
I'm sorry about that. Yes. William. All right.
Thank you. he was very good, I think, on let us say more traditional art.
Yes.
But I think he overwrote. You see, my problem is, and this we might come to this, having worked for written the news on the BBC for so many years.
Yes.
I was used to short, sharp sentences.
We could go into it. Do you want to hear any more
Absolutely. About my art?
Let us
bang on about the government for a minute.
Whatever.
How mean they are towards the arts and how they don't understand.
Please do.
How much money the arts bring to this country.
And right. Okay.
They should do rather more to support the arts. I won't go any further. But if the Treasury are listening, find some more money for the arts.
Okay.
Please.
All right. Yeah. And all right. Well, that does bring us to what you for 40 years you worked at the BBC.
I was in the radio news for nearly 40 years. Yes.
Yeah. How did you come to be in the BBC?
It was my first job when I left school. I had no ambition. I had no clue what I wanted to do.
So that led you to the BBC.
Well, as it has a lot of people, I think it led me to. In those days, jobs were not difficult to get, and I applied to companies such as BP, Shell, Mobil, Texaco, and they all interviewed me. I also applied to Martin's Bank, as it was. I applied to the Hawker Aircraft Company, as it was, because they were just over the river in Kingston, where I lived, in Teddington. Yep. And I applied to the BBC, and they all offered me jobs, and I thought, I think the BBC is the best place. So I started at the BBC cutting up newspapers in the news information library.
Right, okay. Why would you cut the newspapers up? What was that?
Well, in those days, you didn't have anything on screen or even micro-fiche or whatever it's called. So you'd cut them up and stick them on pieces of paper. They would be filed in boxes alphabetically under subject.
Okay.
And if
so this
somebody,
is like an archive, it is an of, archive. Of information.
Yes.
Which was gleaned from the newspapers.
Yes.
And this would be consulted by other journalists.
Later, by people like by myself, yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And I think there was also reference to reel-to-reel tape recorders and so on.
That came a bit later.
Okay.
Just pour myself another drink of whiskey.
Yeah.
That's a joke.
It's only water in the studio.
Ah. Shame on you. yes, I left the BBC after a short period and went off to work for Odham's Press, which published Woman and Woman's Realm and various other magazines.
Oh, right.
Based in Longacre in Covent Garden when there was still a market. So you'd walk out and trip over or slip on a cauliflower or something or an aubergine or whatever. But it was a very nice area to work.
Yeah.
But I didn't find the work terribly inspiring.
Hmm.
So I eventually went back to the BBC
And could you do that? You could just come and go? You could just sort of say, I'm leaving now, I'm coming back?
I wrote to somebody in BBC personnel and said, I'm a bit fed up with what I'm doing. Is there any chance? And they said, well, we can offer you a menial job or so.
Yeah.
I thought, well, menial job or not, I'll take it.
Yeah, okay.
And somehow I progressed into the newsroom.
Right.
Somehow. We were called sub-editors in those days. And
Right. Yes. And when was this, roughly?
It was in October 1976.
Right. And that's when you first started at the newsroom.
And the radio newsroom in Broadcasting House in Portland Place.
Okay. Well, I'm intrigued to know. I mean, I'd love to know how the newsroom works. I'd be fascinated to hear an insider account of, you know, who chooses the news, who decides what is going to be the news that day, and so on. I mean, can you give me a sort of...
It was completely different in 1976 compared with 2018.
Right.
No computers. Hmm. For instance, if I was asked to write something, I would be given news agency material to come in on a telex machine.
Huh.
And I'd then have to look at it and try to decide what to write, and then I'd totter over to a typist who was...
So you would choose?
I wouldn't thing. Choose. I wouldn't choose. There would be an editor who would choose,
right.
decide what to go in on the day's running order. If it was, say, a morning news, 7 and 8 o'clock, it would be done in conjunction with the Today programme during the week and on Saturdays, as it still is.
Right.
So I would then be part of the team that would try to write this stuff as best as I could.
When you say write it, you mean you get text and you're basically rewriting texts that have come in?
Let us say there was a plane crash in Tenerife,
and
there were three agencies reporting on it. And one agency said there were 80 dead, another said there were 100 dead, the third said there were 120 dead.
Right.
Which one would you go for?
which one would I go
yes,
for?
Yes, which one would you go for?
I have no idea.
Well, you go for the 80.
I
you
see.
You always go up.
Okay.
But if you say 120 people have died and then it turns out to be 80, you don't wish to correct yourself. But you can then, if you say 80 and then it goes up to 100, you can then say latest reports from Tenerife say the figure is now 120 or 140 or whatever.
Okay. Hmm.
And
but out of the three, I mean, given the question, I would probably say which of these three is the most reliable?
Well, that's the trouble. You don't know because news agencies are not necessarily completely reliable, so which is why, because you can't rely on them or couldn't rely on them, I'm not saying what they're like now, you would always go for the lowest in case there was a mess-up.
Okay. All right.
Or what we call up.
Yes. Yeah.
Got that?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. So this was your task for...
Quite some years, yes.
Right.
And I decided I never wanted to be promoted because I was incompetent, and B, promotion at the BBC tends to entail joining the management, and that's the last thing I would ever want to do.
Why?
Well, can you imagine me being a manager?
Yes, of course.
No, of course not. Don't be silly. You know me well enough to realise I'd last about 5 seconds in management.
I don't think so.
I think so.
I don't know you that well, but
that's very true.
You make it sound like a. It almost puts me. Yeah.
Go on.
No.
Put you on the spot.
The thought's gone. I had a thought. There's a play which I'm afraid I can't remember the name of now, where somebody is a corporal or he's a private, and he's quite well educated. And he refuses promotion all the time because he knows he's going to become part of the establishment or the ruling class.
Hmm.
A bit like getting an MBE, I suppose.
I don't think it's anything like that at all. And I'd ask you to withdraw that nonsense straight away. I can't think of anything worse than being part of the management. You go to meeting after meeting after meeting and...
But wouldn't you be
you
more...
You don't achieve anything because nothing is ever achieved
but
by
as,
management.
But as the sub-editor, you're just a pawn in the game, aren't you?
Well, up to a point, but at least you have the satisfaction of writing a story properly for your editor.
But you're told what to do, presumably.
No, you're asked to write a story given the facts have.
But that's a bit like being a journalist and constantly having your stories rejected or something.
Because
you'd write something and then somebody higher up would say, we're not going to use this.
Well, they might say it's very badly written or things have changed, but not at all.
So would they use everything you wrote then?
If it wasn't squeezed out because something else came in, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you ever resent that?
But being squeezed out? Well, that's the nature of the beast. As news, something else comes in.
Okay.
And there were occasions when I'd finally crafted something and it got chucked out, but I didn't always agree for the reasons.
Right.
But
and you just shrugged and said
I shrugged and grabbed the money and ran.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. So you were in it for the money?
I don't think so. I was in, well, not at the BBC. No, certainly not. I really enjoyed the work. I enjoyed the people I worked with. I wouldn't say I respected many of the management, the middle and upper management at the BBC, but...
For what reason?
A, there are far too many of them, and B, most of them are incompetent, I'd suggest.
Okay.
I suggest. I could be wrong.
Right. Okay.
There's certainly far too many of them.
Okay, so it's top-heavy.
Utterly. Still, in spite of the best efforts of Tony Hall, the Director General, to get rid of them, they're still there because they all cover their own backsides.
Right. Okay.
If that's the right expression.
Backs, I think it is.
Backs. That's right. I was going to say arses, but too much water.
I think. So
far too much. I'm drowning in the stuff.
There is actually.
Oh dear.
No. It's a very substantial. I thought it was a well-written article about you, called "Why Don't We Start at the Beginning," which was written in something called The City Talking.
That was one of the best. Possibly the best interview, apart from today, of course, that I've ever done.
It's a very good interview, isn't it? It's very well written and well illustrated.
What's the name of the man who did it?
Well, it's by someone called Daniel Chapman.
Yes. He's based in Leeds. He came down to London with his producer and photographer.
Yeah.
And talked to me for an hour or so, and I didn't think he was really listening.
Uh-huh.
And then this brilliant article came out.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm really pleased with it.
Exactly. And it's during this interview that this is where it describes you being besieged since morning by journalists and reporters and etc. And there's somebody here, it mentions somebody from the Hepworth, and in the corner of the room she looks appalled.
Naomi.
Mm. and then Tim has settled into a relaxed routine of charming his inquisitive guests and appalling Naomi.
Well, I think I probably said a few things, maybe off the record, off the piece, as it were, which I shouldn't have done.
All right.
Like pouring boiling hot water over the Telegraph journalist, who is, incidentally, poor Telegraph journalist was hovering downstairs. He's become a very good friend now.
Oh, good. Okay.
Would you like to know that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Later on, you say, I don't really want to go into Broadcasting House again.
I didn't at the time, but I have been back three times, I think. I went back when I was given my appointed MBE. I went back to talk about... And I went back to talk about the Hepworth being nominated for Museum of the Year Award last year. And I was I was interviewed by Front Row, but they came to me. I have been back on one other occasion to see a friend in Broadcasting House. But no, I reckon once I was out of there, I didn't really want to see it again.
No.
And going back to the interview on the Today programme, which was at 07:23 in the morning, I saw all my former colleagues who were coming to the end of their night shifts. And it reminded me of how awful I used to feel and look at the fag end of an 11-hour night shift, I thought.
So you'd work through the night on this editing process?
You would, yes.
Right, okay.
Yes.
And can you, just briefly, I mean, who steers the news in this way? I mean, it's interesting to know who selects what's going to be the headline news item.
The question is always, how would you describe news? And the answer would be, it's rather like an elephant. It's difficult to describe an elephant, but you recognise it when you see it.
Hmm.
And you develop a news sense, I think, of what is... Mine wasn't infallible. I mean, things happened and people said, oh, jolly good story. And I say, oh, how boring. But they'd be wrong.
Right.
I'd be wrong, sorry. They'd be right. And sometimes I would push a story. They say, oh, no, that's rubbish. But it would turn around.
Okay. But who ultimately
is the editor of the day?
Yeah.
Since all the newsrooms were brought together, there's much more cooperation, say, between television, radio, online and World Service. But when the BBC newsroom, radio newsroom, was on its own in Broadcasting House, it was very much the editor of the day decided.
So, and there's one editor?
One editor in the newsroom of the bulletin desk, and there was another one of the summaries desks for radio.
And how close is the editor, say, to the government or civil service?
I don't recognise that question.
You don't recognise the question?
No, not really.
Well, so they have no...
How do you mean close?
In terms of... And what can be broadcast as a news item? You're saying that the editor has a complete free hand as to what they declare is the day's news item.
Well, are you suggesting that somebody from the government sitting...
Absolutely.
Behind, well, please don't. That's a stupid idea.
Is it?
Yes.
OK. Well, fair enough. There are people that might suspect that.
I'm sure there are.
Yeah. You think that's paranoia?
I think it's definitely.
Hmm. Okay. All right. The Robert Peston story.
Yes.
You had an upset or a confrontation with Robert Peston, is that true?
Yes, but Robert was being a little difficult, shall we say. He thought that his work for the television 6 o'clock news was more important than what he was supposed to do for me, and I tried to disabuse him of that.
Mm.
And certain words were used that, like, get out of my blank edit suite, and I said, I'll only get out of your blank edit suite when you've changed your blank script. And
okay, there was an issue here.
There was an issue. I think I'd been set up by the editor who'd said, here's the story, go and find Peston. I'd agreed. I said, I don't like this script particularly. I think he needs to change it. And the editor had agreed. And so I went
on what programme is this?
This is the Radio 4 6 o'clock in the evening, 1800 bulletin on Radio 4.
Right. And so you had a certain leverage then.
Oh, we were always asked to look through correspondence scripts, and I discussed that with the editor, and we agreed there were certain things in Robert's script that we'd like to change.
Ah.
And Robert was in
mutiny.
Well, a bit. And anyway, I threw the script down and left the edit suite, and half an hour later on my computer up came the new script. Then up came a top line message saying thanks for your blank blank help.
Right.
And of course we remained good friends.
Right.
It's all done in the heat of the moment. There's absolutely very rarely any animosity clings on.
Really? Oh, what a shame. Is there never deep-seated kind of conflict?
Well, there were always a number of people I disliked working for who we couldn't possibly name because they were so difficult. I could always get round Robert, but there were some.
Yeah.
There was a former economics editor who's now something big somewhere else.
Yeah.
That person was a complete pain, and I once said to them, if you don't tell me what to write in the queue, which was the introduction to this person's piece, I can't possibly put it on air.
Right, right.
I think some of the correspondents could adopt, if you don't you know what I'm talking about attitude.
Okay.
I mean, Peter Jay, remember him? He was the economics editor or something, and he said he was happy if only four people in the country understood his script, which is the biggest lot of bollocks that you can imagine, can't you? Four people, or perhaps it was only two.
Yeah,
it was probably the chancellor.
Well, perhaps he thought his intellect was greater than.
I believe so.
And if you don't understand it, then presumably that's your problem.
If you weren't the governor of the Bank of England or the chancellor of the Exchequer, plus no doubt a couple of high-powered academics, you wouldn't understand it.
Right. Okay.
So that was a disgraceful attitude.
Right.
I think you'd agree.
Yes. Yeah. And you didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge?
I didn't go anywhere apart from Hampton Grammar School.
Okay. And is that sort of quite common amongst the BBC, in the BBC sort of...
I think it's more so now. But
Which one is more so?
Not going.
Not going, okay.
Certainly. Well, an editor of the 6 o'clock news I used to work for, a chap called Tim Bailey, he was like me, he went straight into... I think local papers, didn't go to university.
Right.
I don't think it did him any harm.
Right.
I feel somehow that too much is made of people who go to university.
Right, right.
But that's...
Right.
I think certainly nowadays.
Yeah. Did you watch that series on TV recently? I think it's still ongoing, actually, about the New York Times.
No.
No.
I'm afraid I didn't. I should have.
Okay, yeah, no, it's quite good. So that's sort of in the newsroom of the New York Times, and there's this particular scene where there's a woman and she has to go, she's a journalist, she's one of the main players in the programme, and she has to go to a place, she goes to some, I can't remember where it is, somewhere in the Midwest or something, she's following a story, and she goes into a Starbucks and she's got her laptop and a phone, and basically she's sitting in the Starbucks and she's doing the whole thing on the phone and the laptop. And it's like she has to be ahead of Trump's Twitters or something, you know, or tweets. So they're kind of, the whole thing is entirely what do you call that, in almost incestuous or something. Is that, it's very little to do with actually talking to a real person. I mean, would you say that that is the modern drift to sort of...
I think it could be going that way, yes.
Only going that way, not gone?
No, I think there is probably some hope, but
right,
not sure. I'm not involved with it now anyway, and I... Having had to listen to the news for 40 years...
Yeah, you're a bit jaded with it, perhaps. You've had enough news.
I'd like to look at the headlines, shall we say.
Okay.
And select things rather than having to listen to the whole lot, which is, of course, where online is very useful.
Right. OK. I'm going to play another record now.
Why?
I'll play a quick record, and okay, then we can come back.
You
can
Percy listen, Sledge, you can... or whatever his name is.
Yeah, no, it's not Percy Sledge. No, it's not. It's definitely not Percy Sledge.
Well, I know what it is.
I doubt it very much. Got a bit of hum there. But...
Kunst als Tod! I hate art galleries. I hate art galleries. I hate art galleries. I hate
the white walls.
Thank you for that, William.
That's all right.
Very enlightening. Or would you care to enlighten me?
Well, it's someone called Felix Cubin. I just thought I'd...
No, I haven't come across
it. I just thought I'd throw,
I thought I'd throw it
in as a wild card.
Yes, I enjoyed that.
That's the entire...
It doesn't go any further.
...lyric, as it were.
I've heard
and
worse.
It seemed appropriate somehow.
Did it?
Yes. Would you... What's your own taste in music? You mentioned Milton Babbitt, Cornelius Cardew, and I think Morton Feldman.
Yes, of more contemporary...
It's very avant-garde-ish taste you have.
Well, that's amongst many, many centuries of music that I'm interested in.
Okay.
I find as I get older, I don't really enjoy loud orchestral music.
Okay.
So a lot of...
Although you were interested in the Stockhausen that was shown at Tate Modern recently, or played at Tate.
Performed, yes.
Performed,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You would have gone to that.
I could, yes, and there was some Berio on Radio 3, if we are allowed to mention the BBC again.
Of course,
again,
absolutely.
Which I did find, even though it was loud, noisy and large, I just don't really enjoy, say, great Tchaikovsky symphonies any longer. Lots of people bashing away and scraping away.
Yeah.
I much prefer string quartets, Lieder, song, solo recitals, things like that.
And how's the art collecting going now then? Are you still gathering art? You're still sort of...
I'm still horrifying Anne-Marie by coming home and saying, oh, didn't I tell you about this? I bought this.
Oh, that's interesting. You'll get people coming to the bookshop and they say, I cannot tell my wife that I've just spent £100 on more books, and they have to sneak them into the house. Mm. Is that what you have to do?
Well, books are much easier, aren't they, than art?
Well, you could take little paintings in.
Yeah, but you've still got to put them on the wall, and Anne-Marie is going to notice, A, that the wall has changed a bit, and B, that I've been banging away with a hammer and a nail.
Right.
So it's very difficult. So I now adopt the idea, I agreed to that months ago, and I've just been paying it off.
There is a story there, isn't there? Because I think you did say that sometimes you have to pay an instalment
for
these.
Nearly always.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
Why not?
Well, I don't know.
How else can I afford it?
I don't know.
I don't go to auctions, you see, because probably things would be cheaper, but you, in theory, you have to pay.
Yeah.
either 30, 60 or 90 days, I don't know what it
right,
is.
Right.
But with galleries, you can... I won't name any galleries, but I've been extremely well treated by a number of them over the years who've allowed me lots of time to pay.
Right.
And even discount as well.
Okay. Well, that's a useful tip, isn't it, for people that want to buy
yes.
art?
Yes.
You can go and negotiate with a gallery.
Absolutely.
You could say,
yes.
I'll pay you whatever, on monthly.
12 months or whatever.
Right.
Or you can say either I'd like to pay you over time or can you give me a bit of discount? But
yeah.
My advice to people also is don't ever buy anything because you think it's going to be a good investment. That is, because as we were saying earlier, it has to. Hit you somewhere.
Right, right. But has your collecting been an investment? Do you think
Well, the Richter was.
Well, certainly.
That probably went up by about, I don't know, 10 times.
10 times,
yes.
Yeah, easily,
maybe
I would think. Yeah, yeah.
15.
Yeah.
But that was purely, I had no idea at the time. I've never ever bought with the idea of a good investment, and I've never ever bought... Because it's a name.
Uh-huh.
I have to really like the work, respect the work, want the work.
Right, right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Much as anything I've said makes sense. Do you reckon your boss is listening upstairs and his
I think he's very busy with his own...
Problems.
You know, yeah, his problems.
Yeah,
grant applications and so on.
Very important.
Which is an ongoing,
yes.
What do you call it, pushing the rock up the hill thing.
Oh, yes.
Is it this thing of Sisyphus?
Sisyphus,
or
yes.
Yeah.
Get to the top and down it goes.
Yeah, it's never ending.
Yes, I know. Well, it's like that in the art world. You're forever. It has to be said, the Wakefield Council have been extremely generous with the Hepworth Gallery over the years.
Yeah. My partner wanted me to throw a question at you, which is sort of a bit of a googly, I suppose.
We'll be seeing her later, won't we?
We will, but I'll just sling this one at you and you can sort of
Google.
Bat it over the boundary if you want.
Or Chinaman.
Why is Eddie Mair leaving?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
No insight.
There are a number of things that have happened there, I think.
Perhaps for listeners to Resonance, we should explain who Eddie Mair is.
Eddie Mair has presented the PM programme on his own now for about 15 years.
Right.
And I don't know why he's leaving. I think there has been some dissent. I think the editor of the PM programme was removed recently.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what's going on.
You don't?
The way the BBC management behaves towards its staff is not very nice, I'd say, on occasions.
Only on occasions, okay.
Well, right, most of the time. Let's face it, you could run the BBC. You could broadcast every day without any of those gits in the management.
Okay, all right. So you're a grassroots person.
That's why I didn't ever want to go up. It's why I'd never want to be a politician, because I just wouldn't be able to stand it.
Right, 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 right.
Well, like you, I'm sure you always think you know how to run the world, but you...
No,
you want to.
No, definitely not. I don't think I know anything anymore.
Oh, I don't.
I've given up trying to know anything.
Have you?
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't give up.
No.
William, that's not good.
Well, no, I think it's probably quite a good, healthy attitude, actually.
No, I think you should keep
up people
the
that
fight.
Know, people that think they know are the problem, aren't
they?
Well,
you hope you know, but you'd like to put things to rights, but you don't really want to get involved because it would involve you in... dealing with such unpleasant people, probably.
Yes, right. I'm desperately trying to think of that quote by John Cage about don't try and improve the world; you will only make things worse.
It's
not a bad quote
to hang on to. I still do get. You're looking at the clock.
I am looking at the clock.
I still get worked up about things.
We've got
how long have we got?
Not long. I could sort of finish. We can play out with Felix Cuban. I hate art galleries.
We could, or we could sing a song.
What do you want to sing?
I don't know.
I'm up for that.
We could sing the Red Flag.
Oh God, no! Please, no.
Or we could sing the National Anthem, but no, that wouldn't go down very well.
No. I'd just like to thank Tim Sayer, MBE. Bequeather of his vast art collection to the Hepworth, tell me what it's actually called?
The Hepworth Wakefield.
The Hepworth Wakefield?
Yes.
Which is a museum
institution? It is a public gallery, a most beautiful gallery designed by David Chipperfield, and it's in Wakefield in West Yorkshire. 2 hours on the train from King's Cross. Jolly.
How many works of art have you donated?
In the end, probably about 500.
500?
Me and my wife.
Brilliant.
Have done it.
Well, well done. And you deserve your MBE.
That's very kind of you to say that.
That's all right. Even after all my cynicism.
You've gone off mic. It's been an absolute pleasure.
We're still on mic, just about, but not anymore. Thank you very much, Tim.
This programme has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.